British defenders of Tony Blair's policies in Iraq have been stressing the special relationship between the U.S. and Britain based on common ties of language. But as our linguist Jeff Nunberg points out, those family ties, like all family ties, are complicated.
As British demonstrators were organizing for yesterday's anti-Bush protests, the right-wing Daily Mail warned that if they damaged the relationship with America, they would damage Britain as well. This is our closest and most reliable ally, the papers said, tied to us by a shared commitment to freedom, by a common language and a common history, not to mention immensely important trade links. The references to a common language are de rigueur whenever Britons are defending the special relationship, a phrase that they use a lot more than we do. But historically speaking, it was the special relationship that created the common language rather than the other way around. It wasn't inevitable that the two nations would think of themselves as speaking the same language. People often distinguish separate languages with varieties that are no more distinct than British and American are, like Dutch and Afrikaans or Norwegian and Danish. In fact, in the decades following the American Revolution, people like Adams and Jefferson argued that Americans should break off their linguistic ties with England just as they'd thrown off its political yoke. Not that we were about to switch to speaking Greek or German, but over the course of time, American would become a language distinct from the rest of the world, as Noah Webster put it. And just to make the point symbolically, Webster went about changing American spelling so that Americans and Englishmen would wind up writing honor in different ways. It wasn't until 50 or 60 years later that the English and Americans grudgingly accepted that they would maintain their linguistic union, like a couple that goes through a trial separation and then decides to stick it out. That realization no doubt reflected the pull of a common literary and political heritage, but it also owed a lot to the neurotic dependencies that can bind families more closely than mere history does. If England and America didn't think of themselves as speaking the same language, after all, the English couldn't accuse us of mangling it. And we couldn't have the satisfaction of knowing how much our cheeky linguistic hijinks annoyed those stiff grown-ups back in the parlor. The British have always had a high time portraying Americans as backwoods buffoons who spout a mixture of slang, malaprops, and bloated pomposities. For them, America was the source of all linguistic corruption in something like the way we think of California today. In 1869, the English critic G.F. Graham accused Americans of taking reckless liberties with the language. Words like slick, spry, and boss are not English words, he said, and we may pretty confidently expect that they will never become English. True, the British have always overdrawn their depictions of American speech. Dickens parodied it so broadly in his American Notes that Emerson felt obliged to complain that no such conversations ever occur in this country in real life. But if no American actually talks like those caricatures, George Bush comes pretty close. British critics of Bush and his policies may make a point of saying that their beef is with the president and not the country. But it's certainly convenient that Bush fits the negative stereotype of Americans so neatly. For their purposes, he's a self-made straw man. The London Sunday Times, which has been supportive of Bush, recently asked 2,000 Britons which characteristics they most associate with the U.S. president. The largest proportion said he was a danger to world peace, but that response was closely followed by the adjectives stupid and incoherent. And in the Times of London last week, the conservative columnist Matthew Paris observed, not entirely approvingly, that these days any English comic can get a laugh with a joke that depicts Bush as a loud, bumptious, ignorant, crass, narrow-minded, conspiring, lethal zealot. As Paris notes, the trouble with Bush jokes is that they're really about Americans. Of course, a lot of people on this side of the pond think of Bush as a kind of America joke, too. That's the price we Americans pay for the special relationship. We all have a little introjected Englishman sitting on our shoulders, clucking his tongue at our ignorance and faulty grammar. And it can be embarrassing to see the flesh and blood embodiment of those deficiencies sharing a platform with Tony Blair. But nowadays, Americans seem to be making less fun of Bush's linguistic derelictions, whichever side they're on. Before the September 11th attacks and the Iraq War, the president's supporters could make light of his gaffes as harmless foibles. Now even that concession seems to undercut their efforts to drape a Churchillian mantle over the man and his language. An article in National Review goes so far as to describe him as speaking with Churchillian clarity. I doubt whether even the Daily Mail would have ventured that description for a British audience. Bush's language has become a less important issue for his American critics, too. Not that they don't still regard him as an ignorant pseudo-bumpkin who embarrasses the country, but now they're concerned that he's making America look bad in much more dangerous ways. Nowadays, their anger doesn't have to do with the fact that Bush doesn't talk like Tony Blair, or for that matter, that Tony Blair does.
Jeff Numberg is a linguist at Stanford University's Center for the Study of Language and Information, and the author of The Way We Talk Now.